Hey there, it's Colt Cabana. Thank you so much for checking out the past shows from the archives. All the past ones in this feed are ad-free. I took out all the ads. If this is something you like, you can listen to every single episode of the Art of Wrestling podcast dating back to 2010, absolutely ad-free for only $4 a month on my Patreon. That's patreon.com/Colt Cabana. All right, enjoy the show.
This is the Art of Wrestling with professional wrestler Colt Cabana.
All right, how you doing? Come on in, sit down, relax, put in those tweaked audio earbuds. You're about to listen to the Art of Wrestling. It's a professional wrestling podcast. It's a life podcast. Hey, it's a personal journal. It's an entryway into the minds, the souls, the hearts, and the lives of the people involved in the world of professional wrestling. I am your host. My name is Colt Cabana. I am a man with very sunburnt shoulders and nose. I'm a personality. I'm a podcaster. Most importantly, though, yeah, I'm a professional wrestler, and I am sitting here live in the studio apartment in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, before we go any further, this is a fan-supported and listener-supported podcast supported by people just like you. We give it to you free of charge every single Thursday on WeLoveColt.com, Stitcher Radio, and on iTunes. Some great ways you can support: rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, tell somebody, let somebody know via mouth, via social media, or if you got a couple bucks left over in your pocket and you want to give back monetarily, you can. ColtMerch.com and DigitalColt.com. T-shirts, buttons, pictures, posters, DVDs, plus premium podcast, $5 wrestling movies, the Wrestling Road Diaries available to download, all of that and so much more. I appreciate every purchase made at DigitalColt.com and ColtMerch.com. All right, the guest this week, yeah, that's correct. Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. We do not sit down in a throne or a mansion or a spa of any sorts. I wish we weren't there in his limo. No, Jason Maples put on a convention for the EWF. And here's how this works nowadays. I have always known Ted DiBiase. I've known him for many years. He was my agent in some of my WWE matches, but that's just kind of a disconnect of generations, and you know, I'm not about to go up to him and ask him to be on my show. But as things are growing here and things are getting better, Greg Carter, who works with Ted on his websites and his book and a movie coming out, he came to me and he was like, hey, I want to make this happen. Ted was all about it, so it's kind of just about getting that middleman, and Greg, big thanks to you, and this way we get Ted DiBiase on. Nothing weird, no anxieties, and I think anxiety is a big key word for me as of late. I'll go into it as I describe what I did this weekend. Very busy weekend for me, man. Crazy, crazy travel schedules, crazy everything. Friday morning, I flew to 3XW in Iowa. Then Saturday morning, I woke up at 5 in the morning and I flew to Syracuse for 2CW. And then Sunday morning, I got up again at 5 in the morning and I flew to Puerto Rico. Monday morning, slept in, missed my flight. Now, the worst thing possible, right, is missing your flight in Puerto Rico and having to stay in extra day. But that's where all this anxiety, I think, all comes in play, because I had such a great weekend. I had such a great time taking in wrestling. You know what the Wrestling Road Diaries is all about: taking in the world around you, taking in these gifts that are given to you as a traveling man, as a professional wrestler. Sometimes I don't take advantage, and I felt like I did a good job this week. You know, there was a wrestler that used to wrestle around these parts named El Generico. He moved back to Tijuana, unfortunately, and he's not on the scene these days. But he was a guy who was all about taking advantage of where he was. Because the reality is yeah, I'm traveling around the world for free on somebody else's dime. It's the greatest thing ever. And lately, I've been that guy who's just kind of sitting in the hotel room after the show waiting for the next town. And I'm 32, and I can say I've been doing this a long time, but also I'm 32, and I'm not like that old-time fuck. So I got an email before the show in Iowa from Michael, who's a photographer. He's like, hey, man, let me take some pictures of you, whatever you need on me. Here's my website. I do nice photos. And he did. He did great photos. But I was kind of scared. Like, it's easier for me to just go to the hotel or the show and just hang out and wait for, you know, my time to perform. Those are the thoughts going in my mind. Like, I'm not sure about this guy. I don't know what's going on. But then I get to the show. We do the pictures there. He's as nice as can be, a normal dude. And those are just my anxieties of like, I'm not sure. But the reality is fuck, man, just a fucking normal guy. After the show, he's like, let's go to Guar. Let's go to Guar. Him and his friend Caitlin, they listen. They're like, let's go to Guar. In my ear was a non-English speaking luchador saying, si, amigo, go to Guar. And I did, and I had a great time. And I took in my first Guar experience, who I've loved ever since Beavis and Butthead and Empire Records.
kids.
And that was thanks to letting go of my anxieties a little bit, and also because of this world of pro wrestling. And then on the flip side, the guys from High Spots were doing the iPay-per-view for WWL, and they were like, hey, we're spending an extra day in Puerto Rico. And in my mind, I'm like, nah, I'm going to go home and sit in Chicago. I'm not going to say the gods told me, but I haven't missed a flight because of my alarm, I would say, ever. And for some reason, my alarm did not go off at 4:30 in the morning, and I'm sitting there in Puerto Rico, and I have missed my flight. One phone call to United, I got a flight the next day, and thanks to WWL and this wrestling life, I am on a beach in Puerto Rico, getting sunburnt, taking it in, living the life of a professional wrestler. You know who else probably lived that life way better than I did? Ted DiBiase. And he's coming up in a bit. Song this week, Ted DiBiase, Million Dollar Man. He's got one of those songs that's ingrained in all of our minds for the rest of time, I believe. So we'll listen to a little bit of it, and we'll get right to me and Ted talking a little wrestling.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the Million Dollar Man $1 million man. And you will be bought.
So the podcast here with Ted DiBiase is it's meant to be conversational, and the hard part of it, but you know, for us, we're in the locker rooms, and I'm talking with my friends, and we're having conversations, and that's what kind of we kind of put on the podcast. But gotcha. When we have the generation gaps,
yeah,
it's a little harder for me and you to be buddy chum chum. You know what I'm saying? It's more like, hey, teach me everything I want to know.
Yeah,
but I do want to make it like, you know, a nice conversation with us.
Sure, man. I mean, I'm easy. You know, I don't. You know, you're not talking to the warrior here.
Right. Did you have guys where, man, I've had so many like life conversations in the locker room of, you know, it's not wrestling, but it's like whatever, women, you know, yeah. Road problems. Like, did you have your crew?
You know, it's funny. There were guys that, like when I think back about my career, when I think about the guys who influenced me the most, Those were the guys that actually were just ahead of me, that taught me, that groomed me to be a wrestler. Guys like, you know, Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr. and guys like Dick Murdoch and a guy named Killer Carl Cox, who was a tremendous heel. And not too many people today, you know, remember those guys. You know, you got to really... Very seldom, like when I say Killer Carl Cox, like, oh yeah, I know him, but you talk about a consummate heel, unbelievable. And a guy who just recently passed away in February, Cyclone Negro. Cyclone Negro was actually from Venezuela, and you know, he's built like a tank, and he was the kind of heel that my dad was. You know, when I would watch him work, I pictured my dad. Very, very rugged, very believable. But those were the guys that influenced me in terms of...
Were these your buddies? Like,
well, you know, actually, you know, like, they became friends, but, you know, like, it was the same thing. It was like, they were the guys I looked up to.
Right.
You know, I grew up in an era where if you're a young guy in the dressing room, and especially not a wrestler, you didn't say anything unless you were spoken to, and even when you first started, it was... You know, you showed that respect to the guys that were, and you know, and I don't know how much different that is now, but it certainly was more. You know, there was more respect, I think, shown to older guys back then. But I don't have any. You know, like today, I mean, like I have a lot of guys. You know, the guys that I meet that are like wrestling with my son in that era, this new era. Mm-hmm. I said, all those guys are very respectful. They come up, they shake my hand. How you doing, Mr. DiBiase? Da 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 da. Make me feel like an old man.
You remember those. That's got to be weird. Like, you remember those guys when you were the young guy, and you were probably going up and shaking
right,
them.
Right, exactly.
And now...
Yeah, and now it's like I'm going, I'm the old guy.
And do you remember those guys going, oh, don't do that, I'm the old guy.
Yeah.
The real feelings. Well, but I can speak for my generation and say that there are some of us, I think, who would know who a killer Carl Cox is, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. But there are a lot who don't.
Yeah, I'm just saying fans.
Oh, I'm speaking for the wrestlers.
Yeah. Oh, but for the wrestlers. Yeah. Well,
when you talk about respect to sitting as a young guy in the locker room, especially at 15 years old, there are some guys that come into wrestling now who aren't really versed in much. There are a lot that do love it and do get the respect issue, but there are some that don't. Like, I understand that you're yes sir, no sir, mouth quiet. Was there anyone, or were those guys quickly just thrown right out of wrestling that wasn't like that?
They didn't show the respect?
Yeah.
Back in the day, it was like, it was just, that's the way it was. You know, if you were, if you were cocky and you didn't show the respect, if you weren't just tossed out on your ear, you were either... viciously ribbed into submission. you were made to know. It's like I was, I was talking to Jason upstairs, Jason was very close with Bam Bam Bigelow. And I told Jason, I said, the first TV that I came to as the Million Dollar Man, they did all the vignettes, but the first TV that I did, as I checked into the hotel, Bam Bam was checking in. It was his first TV. But Bam Bam, when he came the first time, he came with a little bit of an attitude.
Okay.
And Andre set him straight. Actually, Andre, kind of roughed him up in a match.
Now feel free to say whatever you want here.
I remember it because, it was in the Garden in New York, and me and Randy Savage had wrestled. We had wrestled in Baltimore at a matinee. And then, boom, on a plane, into New York, and we were in a cage. And we, we're in the dressing room, lacing our boots and everything. Bam Bam came in the dressing room, just grabbed his bag and his clothes, and he went marching out the door, and he says, I quit.
Wow.
And then Andre came in. Andre said, I taught him a lesson, But to Bam Bam's credit, when he came back a few years later and I managed him, he told me, he said, he said, the greatest thing that ever happened to me is what Andre did that night. He says, because I had a bad attitude. I wasn't showing the respect. I was a young guy. I was cocky. And I thought, here I am. I'm big time now. And he said, and he was great after that. So, you're either going to learn it one way or the other, or you're going to be out on your ear.
Right.
Back then, anyway.
I want to... When you say Bam Bam, it sparked something in me because so this is how weird I am, right? I'm just, that era, the generation, to me, I loved the characters and everyone was like, wow, that guy, this guy, this guy. And I was watching like a Bam Bam Bigelow before he passed shoot interview. And it was just like, kind of as an older guy now, I'm 32, I looked at him and I was just like, oh, that's just a dude from Jersey. You know what I'm saying? Like, I could see like he wasn't like Bam Bammed out and he was just like talking like all these Jersey dudes. And so I don't know if it says something that a lot of these guys might have just been guys.
Yeah.
Does that make like when Vince throws all that magic and you see that pyro?
Well, yeah. I mean, my gosh. We're all just guys. it's like, when you. When you leave the building and you put on your clothes and you go back to the hotel, you're just you. And of course, some guys carry it with them.
Yeah.
Some guys, are on all the time. And, and I think, now publicly I was expected to be that way, but in reality I really wasn't. When I went back to hotels and there were kids in there that were those same kids that would yell at me, spit at me, call me everything but a white man, you know, in the buildings were wanting me to sign their autographs at the hotel. I signed autographs. I was like, hey, you know, it's work. Even coming from the era of kayfabe, you know,
you were still signing autographs for those
kids. Yeah, I mean, you know,
what if Vince saw you do that? Would he be okay with that?
I don't think that he would care, because it was still the aura of, because they saw me get out of a limousine and I'm staying at a nice hotel, and every time they saw me, if they saw me in public, there was always the picture of wealth.
Right.
You know.
What if Bill Watts saw you do that?
Oh my gosh. You're fired. Of course, again, we're talking about,
those are two different.
That's, you know, like, it's like, you know, that's when wrestling changed. I mean, and I was that way. When I was watching the early things that Vince did, you know, where he had the almost like the Tonight Show on
Tuesday Night Titans,
and you know, like the, you know, like when they had the wedding.
Yeah.
What was the big heavy set guy?
Uncle Elmer.
Oh my gosh! You know, and I was like,
I just had Hillbilly Jim on here, and he was like,
and you know, and I was looking at some of these characters, and I was watching at home, going, he's killing the business. He's killing the business, because I came from that old school. But reality is, it was a stroke of genius, because what Vince did, I mean, because pro wrestling, you know, back when I grew up in it, was a very, how would you call it? Like a blue collar crowd. You know, it was like, you know, you didn't have any upper crust. You didn't have guys in khaki pants and polo shirts at wrestling. It was like a smoke filled arena, and it was your everyday Joe. It was the working class. It was, you know, wrestling was the working class guy's form of entertainment.
You saw this now watching your dad. Is this are these your thoughts, like watching your dad?
Watching my dad in that era.
And so where exactly, where did you grow up, or did you grow up all over?
I grew up all over, because, you know, wrestlers traveled territory to territory. So, you know, my dad, like so many guys, had his favorite places in, you know, Amarillo, Texas, you know, which was the Funk's territory, was one of his favorite places. And then, you know, let's see, where did I go to? I mean, it's like, let me run it down for you.
I want to know, like, your, when you think back and you're like smoky blue collar, you're obviously thinking of as a child, like, where are those places?
Well, you know, it's like wherever we were. I mean, you know, first grade, Portland, Oregon, second grade, Houston, Texas, you know, south. I mean, Texas is a big enough state. They had three territories, you know, and then, you know, fourth and fifth grade, I was back in Nebraska. I was living in Nebraska, but my dad was actually working Kansas City, 200 miles south, and then went back to Texas, and then, you know, then back to Nebraska. And then when my dad passed away, we were back in Texas again. So, you know, but what Vince did to wrestling was, he took a form of entertainment, and basically he said, okay, we're sports entertainment, so what? We're good sports entertainment. And he dressed it up, the colorful costumes, the music entrances, and made the characters over the top. Because there were always characters. I mean, it's like, you know, people will say, well, Vince created characters in wrestling. No, he didn't. I mean, Hans Schmidt, and, you know, you had, but the characters are all like, you know, it's like post-World War II, you had the bad guys were Germans and you know, Polish guys and the Japanese guys and all these, you know, all the, you know, then it went from that to the Iron Sheik.
And Russians.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And how many Germans were just dudes from Texas?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I mean, Fritz von Erich.
Right.
You know, Jack Atkinson's his real name, right? You know, Fritz von Erich, you know, and who else was there? Oh, my gosh. There were a lot of Germans. You know, I'm brain dead. I can't think.
I went over and did shows in England, and they were like, oh, you're British today. Like on those camps, you know, camps. And they're like, I come out waving my, and I was just like, oh, this is probably what it was like to be a Russian in the 80s.
But what Vince did is he made it family entertainment. You know, like, I mean, my character, the Million Dollar Man, I was like Snidely Whiplash. You know, it's like if you were to, you know, put the long mustache on me, you know, and be, like I'm gonna tie the fair maiden to the railroad track.
Did you think about growing that out?
No. but over the top characters. And, you know, of course, when I first saw it, because I grew up in that old school, and I was I was programmed to believe, well, we understood that a lot of educated people are real athletes, guys that have been in a real fight, watch wrestling for 10 minutes, go, wait a minute. You know, he grabbed me by the hair and he ran him across the ring. Mm. Why'd he go? You know, but you made it as real as you possibly could. And there was always, it's kind of like you go to a magic show and you know there's no real magic. It's illusion, but you just don't know how they do it. And that was the intrigue. And so, like going to a movie, you go to wrestling and you get caught up in it. Well, that's what it was. It's just that in the older era, it was presented in a much more, I guess, brutal and realistic way.
Did Bill Watt, I'm going to put a lot on Bill Watts because I always enjoyed your UWS stuff. And he's a very, I guess, would say intriguing guy. And was he like, guys, this is one, you let them know this is 100% on the up and up. Was that his mindset?
Yeah, I mean, it was old school. It was like, it was total kayfabe. You know, if you're a good guy and if you're a babyface, then you're a babyface. And if you're a heel, you're a heel. And it's not like, you know, you don't go out and mistreat anybody, but you're just smug and you don't talk to the public, you know, and da 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 da. And, you know, you more or less live it, you know, especially going to shows. And, you know, it was like if you were caught writing with a baby face and you were a heel, you'd get fined, you know?
And wasn't his rule, if you get in a fight, you better win or you're fired?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
was there guys that, do you remember recall stories of guys losing fights and getting fired?
I can't think of anybody. I can't think of anybody, but that's what he would say. I mean, and you could understand that.
Sure.
So
if you're running a business.
Yeah, you're running a business. But,
so you were talking about your character you probably gotten this a lot, but so the $1 million man, how were you financially as a child? Like, was this something crazy to you? Or, I mean,
you mean the character?
No, you. Were you guys okay as like well off or?
Oh no, I mean
were you a $1 million man?
No, my gosh, my dad was he was a pro wrestler. Right. And he came from a poor Italian family in South Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay.
You know, the house that we lived in Omaha was basically a one bedroom house, and what we did is we turned the attic into a bedroom, and my two brothers and I, that's where we slept, and there were two beds. There was a queen size bed on one end of that room. And me and my younger brother slept in that bed together. And my older brother had just a twin bed. And then the real bedroom, the one bedroom house was down, the one bedroom was downstairs. And you had to go through the bedroom to get to the bathroom. It was a very small house. So I go back to Nebraska and I look at that and it's like, I'm amazed. So no, I didn't come from a wealthy family or.
When you say you slept in those quarters, I'm always curious, like, were you one of those kids that were like, this is the worst, or this is how we live, or one day I will be this, or this is fine.
I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't bad. It wasn't, you know, we weren't like dirt poor, or, you know, hurting and begging for food. I mean, but we were not wealthy.
Okay.
We, you know, it was like you were the average Joe.
All right.
You know, working class Joe.
When Vince McMahon started taking everybody from the territories, Roddy Piper's, Junkyard Dogs, Macho Man's, like, just from my perspective as a fan, even as like a smart little 9-year-old fan, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I was always like, to me, like, you weren't kind of taken early. And I don't know how you see it or how anyone sees it, but this is how, like, I saw it as a 9-year-old.
Right.
It's like, oh, they didn't take Ted DiBiase. He was still in UWF. And then, like, he was kind of taken later, but then plucked, like, right into that main event spot. I don't know where any of your head was, but, like, when he was started plucking people from territories, like, where were you at that point?
Oh, okay, well, number one, there was a time when Vince was going to put his show on TBS. Okay. I was wrestling in Atlanta. I was wrestling for Georgia Championship Wrestling at the time. And we go to TV one day, and there's Pat Patterson. And basically, he makes this announcement. Hey, guys, you know, we're coming in. We're going to be a part of this now. And this is what's happening. And he said, I don't want anybody to worry. You've all got jobs. Nobody's getting fired.
Well, this is the one picture with Vince in front of the TBS sign?
Yeah. And it's like, and this is before, you know, again, of course, what Vince wanted to do is Vince wanted to bring his programming in and put it on TBS. Ted Turner wanted his own show. And that was the disconnect between the two of them. And, you know, I think Turner was crazy. We all do now. But basically, I got Pat off to the side. And I said, Pat, I grew up in this business. And I said, I understand. And I said, timing is everything. And I said, there's a difference between having a job and having a position. And I said, and I know right now, if I stay, I don't have a position right now because Vince has got these guys. And I know who those guys were. Well, you know, up until that time, you know, I mean, I had been, number one, I had been with Watts. And then I hadn't been back in Georgia that long. And I really wasn't crazy about that. You know, I wasn't like, oh gosh, you know, when's he going to call me? I mean, I was against it for a while. And everything changed. Everything changed when I walked out of my hotel room in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I picked up the USA Today newspaper, and the front page says, World Wrestling Federation, WrestleMania 3 sets indoor world attendance record. I went, well, you know.
And the show before you had just wrestled like 400 people.
Yeah, it's like, you know what, I get it now.
Right.
I get it now. And so I understood, you know, even if it wasn't exactly what I wanted, I knew if I'm going to stay alive and make a living in this business, that's where I need to be. And that's where it started to change for me. And here's what happened. The other reason that I wasn't just dying to go to the WWF is I was going back and forth to Japan. I had just made a deal. I mean, I was for about a year. Now in Japan, there were two major companies, All Japan and New Japan. And the most popular foreign wrestler in the history of Japanese wrestling is Stan Hansen, hands down. Stan Hansen and then Bruiser Brody. Actually, I'd say Terry Funk, but Hansen and Brody as a team, unbelievable. Well, Brody decides he's going to jump companies, which, you know, that was unheard of. And that's what he does. He goes from All Japan to New Japan. He makes a deal with them.
Was that before the Bulldogs did it? Right?
I'm not sure.
Because that was a big deal too, right? When Dynamite grabbed. Okay.
Yeah.
But still weird, just crazy to do it.
Yeah, because, you know, the thing over there was loyalty. Loyalty's everything. Mm-hmm. And so when that happened, you know, I had been going to Japan for, you know, I'd go for at least one tour a year. And I went for All Japan because the Funks booked a lot of the wrestlers for All Japan. And my relationship with them, that's where I started. And I've known those guys all my life. So Stan Hansen comes up to me one night and he goes, Ted, he says, and you got to understand, you know, not only the history of, I mean, Stan Hansen is another one of the wrestlers that came out of West Texas State, you know, product of the Funks as well. Bruiser Brody was. There's a bunch of guys that came out of West Texas.
That college, right? The football.
Yeah, West. Yeah. You know, me, Stan Hansen, Brody, Dusty, me, and Tito Santana and Tully Blanchard were all on the same team.
That's so wild.
But anyway, Hansen comes to me and he said, Ted, he says, you know, Brody has just jumped and he's gone over to New Japan. He said, I need a new tag team partner. Would you be interested? And I looked at him and I said, are you kidding? I said, interested? I said, is the Pope a Catholic? I mean, are you kidding? He said, no, why would I kid you? I said, absolutely. Because I knew, I mean, this takes me now in Japan and elevates me to a whole new level.
But if you're at NWA, now you're with Crockett and NWA at this point?
No.
Okay.
No. This is before Crockett and that thing happened. This is when I was still wrestling for Mid-South.
Are you loyal to Mid-South at this point?
Well, yeah. I'm loyal to Mid-South, but here's the deal. This is when Vince was just starting to do his thing. And I had left Georgia. I went back to work for Mid-South, and I was making the trips back and forth to Japan. And I went and I told Bill, I said, look, Bill, I said, I've made a great deal in Japan. I'm going to be going to Japan 4 or 5 times a year. And I said, but when I come back, I'm working for you.
Okay.
And so, but here's the deal now. You talk about a deal. So I go from making one trip a year to Japan to, I'm making 4 or 5 trips, and I said, well, how many weeks? And I asked Giant Baba, how many weeks do you want me to come? He says, how many weeks do you want? Like, you want to come on all the trips? Mm. And I was like, wow, incredible. So anyway, and my deal went to first class round trip airfare. Mm. And of course, over there, they pay for the hotels anyway. The only thing you pay for is your food. And now that we're talking, this is 1985, 86. And I went from making whatever I was making to $1,000 a day, guaranteed. So if I go over there for 3 weeks, I'm there 21 days, I'm going to make $21,000.
You're like, can I be there cash 365 days?
Plus, part of that deal was Japan paid my tax. In other words, I didn't pay tax in Japan. And so anyway, it was a great deal.
Right.
So I wasn't like chomping at the bits to go to the WWF. So now I'm Stan Hansen's tag team partner. I'm going back and forth to Japan. And this thing, the WrestleMania 3 thing happened. And one of the guys that was working for Bill now, because Bill had bought Houston, Texas, was Bruce Prichard. Because Bruce had been working, he's from Houston, he worked for Paul Bosch. And Bruce and I had been, we've been kind of buddies, and he says to me one night in Houston, he says, hey, I'm getting ready to go up to New York and interview for a job. And I said, hey, I said, when you do, I said, throw my name out and just see if anybody, takes the bait.
That's kind of how wrestling works a little bit, right? Like, yeah. Hey, buddy.
Yeah,
take this name.
As long as you're up there, I said. I was up there before, and I talked to, I talked to Pat Patterson, and back at the time, and so I don't think they think I was even interested. Mm. I said, but just throw my name out there. So I go to Japan, and he goes to New York. Well, I get it. Now here's what happens. While I'm in Japan, Bill Watts sells the territory. He sells Mid-South to Jimmy Crockett.
And you can't read this on the internet or anything.
No. I get a phone call from Bruce Prichard, and he said, Ted, he says, Bill Watts has sold Mid-South to Jimmy Crockett. And he said, now here's the other thing. He said, Jimmy Crockett is going to, when you get back, he's going to be at TV. We were doing a TV shoot at Billy Bob's Arena in Dallas. This was when the UWF had started. What happened was, Bill saw what Vince was doing, and that's when he created the UWF. But it was too little too late. It was too late for him to go and build it, and he didn't have the resources that McMahon had. Mm. And he had the know-how. There's no doubt about it, but he just didn't have the facility to do it. So he sells his territory to Jimmy Crockett. So Bruce tells me, he said, Vince McMahon is very interested in you. And he said, just promise me this. When you get back, do not sign a contract with Jimmy Crockett. You have got to wait till you speak with Vince McMahon. And I said, okay. So my first night back was a TV night. And, Dusty was there. Dusty was booking for Crockett. And Jimmy was there. And I said, guys, I don't know what I'm doing yet. I mean, this is all a big surprise to me. I said, I've got a great deal in Japan. And I said, but right now, I'll work the live event, but I'm not going to go on TV. I said, I'm not going on TV yet because I don't know if I'm going to be working for you.
Or start an angle, right?
I said, because, you know, or start an angle. I said, because I said, I've got, you know, an appointment to meet with Vince McMahon. And so, you know, I'm waiting on that call. I remember I went home and, you know, he said, Vince is going to call you. And so, like, I'm home for like almost a week and no call, you know, no call. And I can still remember I was out on my deck, my house. You know, my wife comes running out there. She says, Vince McMahon. You know, and so, and the rest is history. You know, he said, hey, Ted, I got an idea. He said, I think you're the guy. You know, and he said, and I said, well, what is it? Well, I said, number one, he said, I'm not going to tell you over the phone. He says, you know, when are you free to come up here? And I said, well, you know, here's when I can come. And so, boom, airplane ticket to New York, and I get in there and I sit down. And he says, you know, he says, I got this idea. He says, you know, it's, you know, so many things in wrestling have been done, and they've been overdone, and they've been redone. And he
even
says,
then, huh? Especially, you know, now, even, oh, yeah, then, yeah.
And he said, but this is something that's never been done. It's new. It's fresh. And he said, just based on what I've seen of you as a heel character, he says, this is you.
Have you seen anything like that going back? Because you've been around since you were a kid.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of that stuff going around?
What do you mean?
That character. Like, is there anything?
No.
Did you, so nothing, no. You don't even remember anything,
no,
to play,
no,
off of?
Nothing, you know. But as a heel character, I tried to kind of carry myself kind of like I pictured my dad. My dad was always aloof. I mean, like, when my dad... I mean, he was always a heel when I remembered him. He was always a heel, and he always talked down to the fans. You know, like, you know, he called the fans freeloaders. You know, in other words, all you people that are, you know, yeah, you're watching me on television, but, you know, if you're not buying a ticket, you're just a freeloader. Mm. You know, that type of thing. So he, and when he'd go to the ring, he'd carry himself in such a manner. He'd stop and he'd look at people like, you know, kind of like they were trash. You can read that in somebody. So that's kind of the way I carried myself, and that's what Vince saw. And so I said, you know, you're the guy. He said, and I said, I really think that you can pull this off. And he said, you know, I want you to come on board. And he said, it's fresh, it's new. And so he gets a call. He leaves the room, and I'm sitting there with Pat Patterson. And Pat, and I'd known Pat, I'd worked with Pat in New York, you know. Now Pat's Vince's right-hand man. And Pat looks at me and he says, Ted, he says, listen, he says, here's what you need to understand. This is Vince's personal idea. It's not an idea somebody gave him. He said, let me put it to you this way. If Vince McMahon were going to put the tights on and climb in the ring and be a character, this is it. Mm. He said, so you're like his alter ego. Mm. He said, how hard do you think he's going to push this?
Right.
And I went, oh, my gosh. And so then Vince comes back.
When you hear Pat say that.
Yeah. So that was just.
You're like.
Okay. But I still won't know what it is.
Right.
Okay. And so Vince comes back and he says, we really want you to come on board. What do you think? And I said, well, you know, and I'm trying not to. You know, I don't want to be too anxious. You know, it's the old school thing. You know, I'm not just going, yeah. You know, and there really were a couple of people I wanted to talk to. One of them being Terry Funk. And so I said, you know, I need to go talk this over with my wife because I realize that, you know, I'm going to be gone a lot more and a lot of things. And I said, know this, I am very interested. You know, I said, but you know, I just can't just say yes right now. And he said, well, we understand that. And he says, you know, he said, well, how much time do you think? He said, just a couple days. You know, I'll give you an answer, you know, in 2-3 days. And he said, fine. But he wouldn't tell me what the idea was. I had to trust him. I know, in other words, I'm going to agree to come to work for you. And I'm going to agree to take on a character. And I don't even know what it is yet. You know, that's putting a lot of trust in, right? So anyway.
But you saw that paper.
I got you.
That newspaper, right?
Oh, yeah.
It said 93,000.
But I, you know, so I go home and I talk to my wife and I call Terry Funk. And Terry said, you know Terry. Terry's a funny guy. But here's what, you know, Terry, everybody looks at Terry Funk and they go, they think ECW and they think all the hardcore matches. Terry Funk is as good a wrestler as his brother. I mean, if you want somebody to go the old school and the technical wrestling, he can do it all.
Do you want me to do the phone call?
He's so smart.
Teddy, here's what you should do.
That's it.
I've worked for old Vince so many times.
That's good.
He'll fucking pay you. Just fucking do it.
Gosh, Colt, that's excellent.
Is that all right?
Oh, that's great.
Is that spot on? That's what he said. Just fucking do it.
Oh.
Jesus.
And basically, that's what he said. I mean, he said, yeah, he said, Teddy, he says, if Vince has an idea and he says it's handmade for you, he says, pack your bag and go.
Right. And if my father told one of the boys he had an idea, you fucking did it. Right?
So, anyway.
I was gonna say that, like, in my head as a wrestler, saying, hey, Dusty, don't put me in anything because I might have this. I would fear if I didn't have this, then I would not have what Dusty. Then Dusty would be like, well, I don't want you because you're the guy who jumps.
Okay.
But you always had Japan in your back pocket,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
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 That was it. I had the ace in
comforting.
Yeah. You did. You know, it was like, and the other thing, it's another old school thing. It's like my mom and dad, you know, because my dad didn't really want me to wrestle, but it was like when I would hear them talk. The one thing, if you were a smart worker, you know, you never let a promoter know you need them.
Mm.
That was the attitude. You know, as far as they're concerned, you got all the money in China, you know, and it's like whatever you do, don't buy a house in the territory. Then you're screwed, you know, that deal. And so, same attitude. But the ace in the hole was Japan.
Okay.
And so Vince, I call Vince back and I go, okay, I'm your man. I'm in. And I said, so tell me what it is. He said, no, I'm not going to tell you over the phone. So he flies me and my wife back to New York and sits me down and he lays the whole thing out. You know, this character, you know, affluent, over the top rich, thinks he can buy anybody anything, you know, and everybody hates that. And I said, I started laughing. I go, I can't stand those guys either. But I understood because of the way I carried myself, looking down at people, you know, I said, I understood the deal. And he said, you know, you're very articulate. You can do this, you know? And so, and then, you know, all the other stuff that I've talked about so many times, you know, in walks a guy, you know, counts off, you know, $2,000 in brand new $100 bills, puts them in my hand. Here's your flash cash. And Vince said, he says, you know what? He's, you know, the other thing is like, he said, I want you to, you know what, you know, you got to pick it. You got to pick your time. And he says, because these things, when you do these things in public, they spread like wildfire. If you were to walk into a restaurant, you know, and just stand up and announce yourself and say, hey, you know what? I'm the $1 million man. I'm in a pretty good mood today, and I'm picking up everybody's tab.
Yeah.
You know.
The original Twitter.
Oh,
took a little longer.
Exactly.
It took a little longer.
And lay down the cash, you know, get the receipt, bring it back to me, we'll reimburse you.
But he got that.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny that he got the idea of social media, but I'm going to say he was a little late on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, like nowadays he was a little late, but back then, like even though how Twitter works and all that stuff and Facebook and stuff.
I mean, it's like, you know, like word of mouth travels faster than anything.
Mm.
And so, you know, I said, when you go, you know, when you buy a newspaper, you know, pay for it with a $100 bill. People hate that.
Yeah.
You know, this jerk comes in and all he buys is a paper and he hands me a $100 bill. So all of that stuff. And then, you know, the whole deal, the first class airfare, all that stuff. You talk about a guy getting a break. I mean, oh my gosh.
As a guy who's been in wrestling for as long as you were and knows, and I'm not going to say this is you, but the carny ways of the ones that you knew that you traveled the roads with and was a little bit of you like, ooh, I should pocket this $100 bill out of like the $8,000 he just gave me, you know, like I'm doing that right.
the deal was, it's like, and you know, and Vince said it, he said, you know what, Ted, it's an honor system. He said, now, if you abuse this, you lose this.
Well, then he gave you that. Okay.
You know, and so, and that's the way we did it, you know. Oh, my gosh. And I never did abuse it because, you know.
You knew there was more to come, I'd assume, right?
Yeah.
If done right. And so you did do it right. And do you, again, this is just me talking for you, but I have to assume that you went in right away, and this is the problem with our generation, is that you went in right away as an established main eventer, and you did the job, and you did it amazing. And I'd have to assume it's because you had been on the job for so long.
Absolutely.
And the people hadn't, that era had that audience hadn't seen you.
Well, and see that, and that's just it. It's because we're just leaving territorial wrestling. I mean, it's like in territory days, you could work, you know, I could work in Mid-South for you know, and I did work in Mid-South the better part of the first 12 years of my career. I worked in Mid-South. I worked in Kansas City for a short time. I worked in Amarillo, and I worked in Georgia. You know, those are the territories I worked. So when I went to New York, I mean, he told me, he says, because, you know, it's like, and I had just turned babyface again. I had been babyface again in Mid-South for a short time. And I said, it doesn't matter. He said, because as nationally, they don't know you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're going to just immediately reintroduce you as this character.
Can I ask you, from a wrestler standpoint?
Yeah.
Did you have, so you... When you did that first run with the second run, I'm sorry, because you were there a little earlier. Like you were 10, 13, 15 years into wrestling, no?
When I went to the WWF, I had been wrestling 12 years.
12 years. So when is there agents now like telling you how you should do it? Or are you like, no, I got this. I'm going to do it how I do it. And, no, and do you see, frustrations in that?
No, there were, you know, the agents back in those days, all the agents did was bring in finishes.
Okay.
I mean, this is back when the, you know, when the agents understood that they were, I mean, they were old wrestlers, so they understood, they knew who could work and they knew who couldn't work. They knew who needed more information and who needed less. And so, you know, I got that respect right away.
Okay.
You know, here's the finish. And they would just say, I'm going to come back later. Just give me an idea of what you're going to do. And that's what we did. And that's how we ran with it. And, so, We were off and running, man. And of course, the hardest thing for me to do was go back to Japan after Giant Baba had been so good to me and tell them that, you know, I appreciate what you've done for me, but you know what, I can't pass this up. And you know what? And he was a class act. He said the door here is always open. You know.
And I bet going like you have. So much, maybe anxiety. I'm just talking through me.
Yeah.
I would have so much anxiety and like fear and guilt. And then when he tells you, no, it's fine. It just all like melts away.
It did. Yeah. It did. It was like, because I had so much respect for him. I mean, that he had that he had that kind of confidence in me that he would give me that break. And here I am, you know, not even a year later going, I, but he understood. He understood business and he understood how big the break was. And again, smart enough to say the door is always open. And again, to his credit, you know, 1987 is when I went to work for the WWF. And then 92, summer of 93, summer of 93, SummerSlam 93 was my last match for them. And I left and I went back to work for Japan. And I picked right back up where I dropped off. As a matter of fact, I flew back to Japan. They put me and Hanson in a tag match in the Budokan. The first night I was there, boom, we're world tag team champions in Japan. And I was off and running. Of course, that didn't last long because then I got hurt. But
he chewed his word, huh?
Oh, chewed his
word. Cool, and like you, that was probably a worry. And yeah. At the end of the day, you could always go back there.
Absolutely.
I have a friend who's a very top superstar in the WWE right now. And even as big as you are, as big as he gets as a star, he still has frustrations. Now you, man, you were so awesome as like the top heel. You know, as a fan, I would think like, oh, he's just riding it down. But like, was there ever a point where you had like professional frustrations?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, because it's a grind. It's even with the success and everything that comes along with it. There's a frustration in your personal life of not being with your family enough and all those things. All of the reasons that my dad didn't want me to be a wrestler.
Mm-hmm. Now you realize.
I'm realizing it, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, I tell everybody, I said, we were like the old rock and roll song, you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And that's the way it was. It was the next show, the next party, the next, you know, drunk, the next whatever, and the next girl. And of course, I wrote a book about it. I mean, I fell into that trap. I mean, I was out. I mean, I'm the million-dollar man now. I'm throwing around the money, you know, and living it.
What about professionally in terms of, like, creatively?
Now, creatively, you know, I mean, you know, we had more, we had a lot more input when I was there. I mean, just the, it was kind of like, you know, the office knew where they were headed, you know, what the end result was going to be here, you know, like here are the finishes, here's where, and the other thing is we knew a lot more about where we were going. You know, this is what we're working toward. I knew in Market Square Arena when Hulk and Andre wrestled that night and we had the twin referees and I said I was going to, I knew that that was the door that opens WrestleMania 4. That was the lead into WrestleMania 4. I already knew that. I knew that coming out of this thing, I knew that night that coming out of this thing, this is to set up a tournament. You know, this was the build up for WrestleMania 4. And I don't think the guys get a lot of that. I think they get it week to week now.
Right.
And so you didn't have as, you
now, know, as much as wrestling has to evolve.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, but man, that made so much sense back then.
Yeah. and of course you wonder, and of course I'm not there.
Right.
I'm not there. And I tell guys all the time, I mean, the guys today, they don't have the opportunity to learn the business the way that we did because it doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's like, you know, young guys and like guys that work indie shows today, they might work once a week, if that.
Some.
You know, and
I'm working a good schedule here.
Yeah. and you know, but you know, I worked every day.
Right.
I mean, like 300 days a year at least, you know, and it's like when you're working that, you're going back to the same towns on a weekly basis, and so you're forced to think, what can we do to keep them coming? So that's another thing in the learning curve that doesn't exist anymore because you don't have to because they're doing all the thinking for you. Mm. And, you know, it's not, you know, not necessarily a good thing. And so, you know, like, by the time I got to the WWF, I had 12 years under my belt. I had developed my own style. I had watched enough guys work that I took things from other guys and made them my own. And so like now it's you know, it's just, it's harder. Mm. And the other frustration is just, it's the stress. When I left the WWF in 93, I wasn't unhappy with the company. I wasn't unhappy with Vince. I've got to get off this train because it's just the grind.
I've heard
just
it.
Go. And I was just putting my family back together. And, you know, for me to get off the train and go back to where I could just get on the bus and go to the show, I didn't have to worry about flight schedules every day. I didn't have to worry about hotels. I didn't have to, you know.
Oh, the Japanese bus.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice.
And then when I went home, I was home. I wasn't home for 3 days. I was home for 3 or 4 weeks before I had to go back to work. And I needed that break.
Okay.
And so, yeah, just the stress of the grind. And it's funny. Just today I was watching the story of this guy that is from the Philippines that started, you know, his favorite rock band was Journey. And he ends up becoming the lead singer for Journey. I just watched that today.
Yeah.
And I go, wow, man, you know, and it's like as much as he wanted it. And he says that, you know, and then when you get on that.
Oh, is he over it now?
And he's doing it. You know, they're still doing it.
Yeah.
He's like the lead singer for Journey.
But is he not as happy as he?
Well, he just realizes that, you know what, there's a price for fame.
Right.
And, you know, and it's just like, and it can, you got to be careful.
Yeah. Okay, I have to ask this. Where does Virgil come from? Like, who grabbed, is he around? Is he a guy, like?
Yeah. You know,
and we don't have to stick on Virgil. I'm just very curious.
Well, the whole Virgil thing was from the very beginning. They said we're going to give you like a bodyguard slash valet.
Okay.
And from the very get go, you know, the whole idea was you're a loudmouth rich guy who flaunts his wealth and runs his mouth, and then when anybody confronts you, you back up and you put the guy with the big guns up there first. You know, you always got Virgil as a backup. And Virgil was so, and the deal is, even though he's working for you, you know, he's doing your dirty work, you abuse him just as much as you abuse everybody else because that's your nature. And so from the very beginning, it was like one day down the road, Virgil's going to get tired of all your junk, and he's going to...
By the way, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Set. You probably knew, you set that up. That's like a three-year thing.
At the very beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew from day one that whenever we did it, we were going to do it.
But is he just a guy that's around? Is he doing enhancement matches? Has he been around? Like,
you know, well, he had been, you know,
how do you point and go, oh, you're Virgil?
Well, I didn't find
him. Okay, you didn't find
him. I mean, you know, I can't remember exactly who it was, but they just said, you know, this guy's not really, he's not a great worker, but he's got this great look. And that was what it was. He had the big guns and he had that look about him. And so
he could wear a shirtless vest, shiny shirtless vest very well.
And you know, and from the get go, I mean, that was the deal. In public, wherever people saw him or saw us, you know, he was opening doors for me, the whole deal.
Right.
You know, and of course, when we got off work, then we were off work, you know, and that's the way it was, you know, and then we did our thing, you know, and, you know, he finally got tired of my stuff and hits me in the face with the belt and, you know, we wrestled at, I think it was WrestleMania, I think it was 7, out in Los Angeles. But then Roddy Piper was part of that deal, trying to help Virgil along the whole deal. So, yeah. And, you know, that again, I think it was Bobby Heenan. I think it was Bobby Heenan that named him. Let's call him Virgil. Right. Dusty, I love that.
Yeah.
And then he goes to WCW, and they called him Vincent.
Yeah, of course. great, man. This has been wonderful. And you know, you came down, like when I was in FCW, you came down.
Yep.
And a lot of the guys would come down. And the reality is they're like, ask questions. But if I was like, this is why I love having my own podcast and just like, you know, like these are the questions I want to ask. But like, if I'm in a room and all these people like judging me on the questions that I really want to know about, like Virgil and the UWF and you know, it's just like, it's hard to do it. So I appreciate you coming in and
absolutely,
and
man,
really getting to do it. You know,
my pleasure.
Yeah,
absolutely, my pleasure.
You have some great stuff coming out, and you're involved. The book is called what again? Sorry,
The book.
You have, the book's been out for a while.
Okay, the book was out, and then I've added 4 chapters to the book, and going to re-release the book. And the book is Every Man Has His Price, and it basically is, it's not as much of my wrestling story. Of course, a lot of the stuff about my career is in it, but it's more about the spiritual journey I've been on and the struggle with all the things that I would. It's kind of like my dad didn't want me to be a wrestler. Mm. Well, here's why. You know, those things. You know, the struggle within myself and, you know, living life on the road and subjecting yourself to those things and why guys end up, you know, drinking and drugging and all that other stuff. And some guys make it and some guys don't. And, you know, and my, you know, my turning back to God at a point, and my wife's unbelievable faith in God and her willingness to give me a second shot, which is a big part of the story as well.
A lot of man behind the character stuff, right?
Yeah,
which like, I like. I think,
and that's just it. It's kind of like, you know, yeah. Everybody knows that the warrior and I aren't bosom buddies, and you know, and the people ask me, I said, what don't you like about the warrior? I said, well, he just, you know, he doesn't have any respect for the business. And again, you know, I'm from old school. You know, it's like, okay, you know, at least appreciate the guys that helped you. And I don't see that. And nobody else sees it either. You know, but, and I don't know, somehow somebody had asked me if Vince had asked you if you thought the Warrior should be inducted to the Hall of Fame, what would you have said? And I would have said no, because it's not just about, it's not just about how much money you drew. It's about how, you know, how good are you? You know, not only as a wrestler, as a character, but, you know, overall, it's about everything as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Abdullah didn't draw any money for Vince McMahon, you know, right?
No.
And he's in.
Yeah. And, you know, and he has the respect of a lot of guys because, you know, for a guy that was not a great ring technician, oh my gosh, what an unbelievable worker he was. And there's a lot of guys he carried. Well, when you know the business, you understand that. So, and that's, but anyway, understand where you're from and understand, you know, how you got to where you got, you know, and we all need help along the way and appreciate it. and just give that respect. And that's all I was asked of that guy, and you know, I'm still waiting.
Well, hopefully he'll hear it. You're active on Twitter also, right?
Yes, I am. I'm getting better.
Okay.
It's like my son keeps after me, Ted, Junior. He's like, come on, Dad, you got to get with it, you know. So
let's announce that. What's your Twitter handle?
It's MDM Ted DiBiase.
MDM Ted DiBiase.
Right.
Your website where you sell all your stuff and everything?
There's two websites, milliondollarman.com.
Okay.
And then the ministry site is heartofdavidministry.com. And the two existing sites are okay. They're outdated. But a very good friend of mine that we both know,
Greg,
is in the process of bringing all of those, you know, into the 20th century.
Yeah.
You know,
wait, hold on.
You know, 21st century. Yeah. Okay. You know, and they're going to be Twitter and Facebook friendly and all that other
great
stuff. So, and I'm getting there. I'm learning.
Yeah.
And I'm an old timer, but I'm getting there.
It's important it is. And, yeah. I think that says that you realize that. That also you realize to come on here and talk to me, and I appreciate it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Man. Absolutely, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
On.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's Cold Cold Beer. Ha 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 ha. I wish my laugh was like Ted DiBiase's laugh. He could probably make a side job doing laughing. Why isn't he making extra money laughing? Like laughing voiceovers. Man, I don't know. Maybe I'll get into it with him. Maybe we'll put him to work. Maybe I'll put the $1 million man to work. Ted DiBiase was on the podcast. That was fun. I think that was a lot of fun. It was interesting to sit down with him. And cool and normal, you know. He's the $1 million man, but he's just a normal guy. Check out those websites and get with him on social media, right? All right, that's the show for this week. Hey, before we get out of here, let's get into some plugs and
upcoming events.
All right, the best way you can support cultmerch.com and digitalcult.com, t-shirts, buttons, pictures, posters, DVDs, the premium podcasts, all that fun stuff over there. I have a Twitter at Colt Cabana. See who the next guest on The Art of Wrestling is going to be, what I got to say about the world of wrestling or just in general. I have a very public email. If you need something or you're a promoter and you want to put on your upcoming show or convention, coltwrestling@gmail.com. Every single Monday night, I got a new YouTube series, myself and Marty DeRosa, worstpromoever.com. For the easy way to get to that, head on over to the website, welovecult.com. I got two things up there. A, you can see the P.O. box for the snail mail and you can send me something fun. Or B, sign up for the newsletter. It's monthly, no spam, and you'll get links to the bonus worst promo evers, which we only put on the newsletter, and the Facebook/AOW podcast. Like it. We'll talk about each episode each week. Upcoming Saturday, April 27th, Los Angeles, California, wrestlingcares.com. Sunday, April 28th, Toronto, Canada, squaredcirclewrestling.ca. Saturday, May 4th in Chicago, Illinois, and Sunday, May 5th in Los Angeles, California, luchavavoom.com. Go see Matt Classic. Say hi to him. Saturday, May 11th, Newark, Northern California. During the day, a wrestling convention, and at night, a wrestling show, btwrestling.com. Sunday, May 12th, Denver, Colorado, primoswrestling.com. Friday, May 17th, Berwyn, Illinois, aawrestling.com. Saturday, May 18th, Chicago, Illinois, chikarapro.com. Saturday, May 25th, Melbourne, Australia, heading back to Australia, warzonewrestling.com.au. May 31st and June 1st in Perth, Australia, nhpw.com.au. Kevin Steen and I are going over to Perth to take over. All right, guys, that's been the episode this week. Thanks to Greg Carter for the hookup. Thanks to you guys. Thanks to Ted DiBiase. Thanks to Cable Guy Jeff and Stu Stone. Thanks to Kid Russell and Matt Jenkins on the music. This has been The Art of Wrestling. For Colt Cabana, I'm Colt Cabana. Thanks.
Have you ever seen a more gorgeous specimen in all your life?
No, sir.
You know, there are still a lot of people out there who think that their morals and their pride are more important to them than money. Can you believe that?
No, I can't believe it. Because morals and pride can't buy you gold. It can't buy you diamonds, sir.
Virgil, you're learning fast.